Welcome to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you have an animal behavior question, big or small, we would love to hear from you. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And in addition to the calls, of course, we have another topic to share. And what's our topic today, Patricia?
Well, you know, Larry, they say beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
But when it comes to colorful bird feathers, it turns out we humans are witnessing only half the beauty. We'll find out why a little later in the show.
Half? I want all of it.
Well, greedy.
All right.
Unless you get a bird eye, you're stuck.
Well, all right. We'll find out some more about that later on. And we'll also talk with an author about The Lady and the Panda. It's a story about the first panda to come to the U.S. and the woman who brought it here. But first, let's take some calls. The number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Joellen calling from Duluth, Minnesota.
Joellen, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a six-year-old Shih Tzu named Zeppi who, what I thought was a jealousy issue with my boyfriend,
yeah,
because any chance he could get into his office, he would poop in his office.
Oh, and that's not enamoring him of your boyfriend?
Oh, man.
Oh, dear.
He wouldn't do it in any other room of the house except for his office.
Really?
We would leave the house, and if you happened to leave the office door open, you could be gone for 5 minutes and come back, and he'd have done it.
Ooh, okay.
Oh.
And he can go outside all day long because my boyfriend works from home, so Zeppi's home with him all day.
Uh-huh.
And now that we were doing home construction, so now we're living in the upper part, and now the dog has chosen the den.
Okay.
As his
place to go potty.
Poop place.
Right. As Larry described scientifically. Right. So,
and again, he can be outside anytime he wants to.
But do you go outside with him and ensure that he goes potty?
No.
And therein lies the key. Because, you know, you would think, and ideally a house-trained dog means a dog who, when you let them outside, they, quote, do their business, right? But, you know, dogs, they're sort of like kids. They can get distracted quite easily and sort of forget, you know, that they have responsibilities.
Forget why he's out there.
And they don't, you know, we talk about dogs being joyful because they live in the present. So, you know, you can't expect a dog to go like, I should go now because 3 hours from now I won't be able to. So I actually had a dog who I think thought something like that, in that I'd take her outside and she wouldn't go potty. She'd be busy. She'd be sniffing the squirrels and looking for the chipmunks and doing this and doing that. And I'd say, Misty, have you gone potty? And she'd look at me like, oh, I forgot. And then she'd go. And I'd give her a treat. So here's what I want you to do. Put it on cue. Take your Yorkie out a lot. Pretend you're, not your Yorkie, take your Shih Tzu out. Sorry, I don't know where I got that.
I may have to get a Yorkie.
Yeah, really. No, they're harder to house train. Take your Shih Tzu out a lot as if he or she was a puppy. Go outside and put a cue. You can say whatever you want. Hurry up. It's my favorite because that's how I'm usually feeling. And have treats with you and wait for your dog to go to the bathroom. And so the first couple of days, you're going to have to go outside constantly. And otherwise, keep the dog right with you. I mean, tied to your belt if you have to. Right with you or in a little crate if a crate works out for your dog. But ensure that your dog has no choice but to go outside and give your dog the best little treat in the world. So there's this little Shih Tzu with its mouth open and its eyes huge going like, what did I do to get a piece of filet mignon? I can't believe I'm training her to give me steak for going to the bathroom outside. All I have to do is poop. This is so cool. So start training your dog to go outside, and what you well might have to do is just accept that twice a day you have to go outside with your dog and say, did you go potty? And then wait for him to go and then give him a treat for going.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks, Joellen, for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. You know, Patricia, we received an email from Ann, who listens to us on WHRV in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and she has some questions about the young Lhasa Apso that she has adopted.
Yeah, a little Lhasa.
Yeah, a little Lhasa. And she says, when he dreams, his nose twitches, his muzzle moves,
yes.
He breathes faster. How can I tell if he's having a good dream or a bad dream? And also, when he sleeps on his back in a full spread eagle position, what does that indicate? Does it mean he feels safe and secure at his new home and knows that we'll protect him?
I think it does. Yeah. I think it does. I really do. That getting in the position where you're flat on your back and you got your legs sort of, you know,
that's
out in
open.
A yoga position, basically, that, yeah, an animal would never do that if they didn't feel safe and secure. So that's a testament to, one, the environment that you're providing, and also to the genes of that dog. Because, you know, there's some dogs that no matter what you do, they're just not internally secure enough to be able to get in that position. And also, you know, it's partly the way his body's designed. I don't think my Great Pyrenees could lie like that if she wanted to. So it's probably three factors that are in that. But they're all good ones. So that's a good thing.
All right. Now when he's dreaming, his nose is twitching, his muzzle moves, he's breathing faster. How can Anne tell if he's having a good dream or a bad dream?
I'm not sure you can, you know? I mean, that kind of rapid eye movement that corresponds with all those little body twitches and nose twitches. Our noses don't twitch so much, but we do all the rest of it, is very typical of a deep dreaming state in which there's that rapid eye movement that we talk about, where there are different kind of wave patterns being generated by the electricity of the brain in both dogs and people. So I don't know of any way to tell, except, you know, we wake people up, you know, and then they tell us. And, you know, sometimes we don't even remember. You know, one of the interesting things about dreaming is that, as best we can tell, part of what goes on when you're asleep is that all the different areas of the brain which are normally connected when you're conscious and awake still operate, but they no longer communicate with each other.
Oh,
so that's part of the reasons why when you wake up in the morning, you often forget your dreams right away. They literally don't get communicated to the sort of storage sections of your brain. So he might not even remember when he wakes up. Even if you could ask him, he might not remember. The one thing I can tell you is I have seen dogs, and I actually have one of them, who gives signs of being distressed, in that Pippi will start whimpering.
Whining.
As if she's truly distressed. And I have no reason not to believe she is distressed. So I'll wake her up then. But if you just get little twitches, you know, little leg movements and muzzle twitches, I wouldn't worry about it at all. That's a good, healthy thing to have happen.
Excellent. And here's the number to call if you have a question. By the way, we should go back. I should ask you how people can email us with a question.
Oh, we'd love it when you do. Just send us an email. It's really easy. Just send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you have a question you want to talk to us, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Stephanie. I'm calling from Marshfield, Wisconsin.
Stephanie, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm going to be getting married, and I have a little kitty. Well, she's not a kitty. She's going to be 8. And my fiancé has an African gray parrot and a 9.5-year-old Yorkie.
Oh, my.
Yes, and we have to figure out how all of the children are going to get along with each other.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And the best way to introduce Noodle into, my cat's name is Noodle, introduce her into their environment, the best way to go about doing that, and what sorts of behaviors I should accept and shouldn't accept on each of the pet's behalf.
Good question.
In their territory or not.
Excellent question.
Yeah. I was looking for ideas for how to do that.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that cats adjust to new environments very slowly, much more slowly than people and much more slowly than dogs. Is the cat going to be living at home or in a new environment?
It's going to be a new environment for her.
Is it a new environment for everybody?
No, just her.
Okay.
Because I'm going to be moving into his home.
Well, then it's particularly important. What I would do is I would establish a cat room. And is the cat used to sleeping in the bed with you?
Yes.
And is the Yorkie used to sleeping in the bedroom or the bed?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Oh, well, this could be a little tricky. Well, how about separate bedrooms for a while? Just what a newly married
like
couple
any fun.
Wants to do, right?
That's just what I want to hear.
Yeah, how fun is that, right? Well, one of the things that's important, and you have to figure out which room is best, but the cat needs to have a room that's just her space.
Okay.
And it has her food on one side, and it has a nice, exactly the kind of litter box she wants. And the other side has lots of warm, cozy places to be, and none of the other animals ever go in there. So you spend lots of time in there with her, and you don't push it. What you, the worst thing you can do, and it's a very human thing to want to do, is you pick up the cat, you go into the other room, and you sort of push her nose towards the Yorkie, and you say, "See, there, sniff noses." And that's like the worst thing you can do to a cat. Don't force any of these interactions.
Okay.
And then after she's had several weeks in this room, and she seems to be relaxed, and it'll vary tremendously depending on the personality of your cat, then what you want to do is put the little Yorkie in a crate, for example. Put the parrot somewhere else. Put the little Yorkie in a crate, and then let the cat out into a new room. What you don't want is the Yorkie to chase the cat. The worst thing that can happen is the first introduction the Yorkie chases the cat. The Yorkie will learn, this is so fun. And the cat will learn, I'm terrorized, or vice versa. And I have seen it go vice versa, is the cat will chase the Yorkie.
So we introduced them once, and that's what she did. She, like, batted him in the head and chased him, so.
Okay, so it might be, so you're going to have to protect both of them, the Yorkie as well. Be very careful about the parrot. Anybody who has an African gray parrot knows that they can be very territorial. Be very careful about the parrot. I would very slowly make that introduction every time the parrot looks at the cat, who is physically away from the parrot such that the parrot cannot get to the cat, is you're gonna make a little smooching sound, give the parrot a treat as he turns his head to look at you. So you teach the parrot to look at the cat, look away. It's a great generic way of solving potential behavioral problems. So basically the name of the game is go slow.
And good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you very
much.
Yeah,
good luck. Congratulations.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks.
With the pets and with the,
and
marriage.
The marriage.
And the marriage.
Call about your husband on another show.
All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Coming up next, we'll take a look at color from a bird's eye view. Don't go away. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. You are listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. And before we take some more calls, it's time for this week's topic. And you know, Patricia, one of the reasons we're so attracted to birds, I think, is their beauty. But when it comes to identifying color, is there more than meets the eye?
There is, because it turns out the colors that we see are not necessarily the colors that birds see. You know, we've always believed that birds saw the same colors that we do.
Yeah.
And it turns out that in some sense they do, but they also see colors that we don't.
Why is that?
Well, it turns out, this is really new stuff too, it's really fun. It turns out that the biology of a bird's eye, it's quite different from the human eye.
Okay.
You know, you may remember intro biology. We have, you know, the cones are the part of the eye that perceive color, right?
Yeah.
The rods are black and white and the cones are color.
Right.
And we have three different types of cones that allow us to see, very simplistic terms, red, yellow, and blue.
Blue,
and
yep.
All the other colors that we see are kind of a combination of those. It turns out to be a little bit more complicated, but that's sort of
basically a
good basic way. But it turns out that birds actually have four different types of cones, not three, but four. And therefore, they can see colors that are unknown to us. And we just learned that that's actually the primitive condition, is having these four types of cones that sees color in more elaborate ways, and we're a more kind of a less sophisticated, primitive kind of
we're
condition.
We're the more primitive. Okay.
Yeah, and so thanks to studies by, lots of people. Robert Blywise has done work, Muir Eaton, lots of other scientists. We know that that extra cone that birds have, that allows them to see a color we can't, ultraviolet.
Oh, so how does this affect what they actually see then?
Well, you know, it turns out that they have patches on their feathers and on their bodies that we can't see.
We don't see those, yeah.
So, you know, just as if, you know, we're looking at a bird, we'll see a bird with a yellow feathers or a red breast or something. Birds can see these different patches of ultraviolet color on their bodies. The birds may look just black or plain to us, but the birds can distinguish them based on these different patches of color.
Okay, so does that mean that two birds that look essentially identical to us might actually look different to a bird then?
Exactly, and this turns out to have big implications because we've looked at the males and females of many species and said, well, you know, they're exactly alike. And there's actually a lot of science that's been wrapped around, well, why would some birds be different, the sexes, and in other birds, and other species, the sexes be the same? But it turns out that because of this new work on birds and ultraviolet sight, we're finding out that, one, males and females of these species, well, they don't look the same, not to the birds anyway. And also we found there's some species of birds that, two different species that look almost exactly alike to us, and we could never figure out why they don't interbreed. You know, why are they two different species? They look so much alike.
Ah.
Well, they don't look alike. It's just that what's different is invisible to us. And so, Larry, there are all these mysteries of behavioral ecology that are being solved just because we're starting to understand the world from the eyes of the birds rather than from our own. And it's just a great example of how there's no real true world out there. Every animal lives in its own, and we're in ours, which turns out to be a little less sophisticated
than
the birds.
That is really
interesting. Isn't
it fun? Yeah. And if you want to learn more about what we see when we look at birds, or to read more about the research being done on what birds see, we have some links on our website. So go to our website. It's www.callingallpets.org, and you'll get some more information. But now we're ready to take some more calls. And here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Craig from Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, Minnesota. Craig, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
About a year and a half ago, my wife and I rescued a German short-haired pointer.
Okay.
She was about 3.5 then. She's about 5 now. And we've struggled with trying to keep her from pulling on the leash when we walk or run her. We have a little bit of success when we make her walk next to us, but we kind of like to have her in front of us, you know, let her roam around. And when we run, it's easier when she's in front of us.
I'm so glad you're asking this, because this is a sort of time in the history of pets in which somehow somebody went, duh, why are we trying to handle dogs in a completely different way with completely different tools than we handle other animals?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
a collar and a leash is a setup for a dog to pull. You know, the biggest part of a harness that a horse uses to pull a wagon, you know what it's called? It's called a collar. And it goes around the same part of the animal. And the wagon is hitched to the collar. Horses don't pull wagons, they push collars. And wagons are attached to the collars. Collars pull wagons, horses push collars. And dogs push collars too, and you're the wagon. You know, you get hauled along. So here's the good news. The good news is that there are all these new devices that are very humane, that are dog friendly, that work really, really well because they get physics on your side. And my favorite right now is a special kind of a harness. It's not the old fashioned kind of a harness in which you snap the leash to the top of the dog's back, but rather you snap the leash to the front of the dog's chest. And so when they pull against the leash, they can't like sink their body and their shoulder girdle into the collar and sort of pull you down the street.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You have much of physics is just on your side. It works much, much better.
Okay.
And a lot
so it still
of,
goes around the neck?
No, it's like a harness.
Oh, I gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so there's a band around the chest, and then there's a band that goes around sort of vertically behind their front legs. And then you snap the leash to the front of their chest. And dogs accept these. You put them on dogs, and they're like, whatever.
Okay.
We're fine. So they work really well with medium to large size dogs. Now there's another device also from what we understand about walking big animals is called a head halter. And that looks just like a halter that you put on a horse. And that also can work very, very well because when you pull on it, it actually pulls your dog's nose back towards you.
Okay.
And where go you know, where the nose goes, the body goes.
Yeah.
They don't actually have a lot of strength in the lateral muscles of their neck. The issue with head halters, they work very, very well in some dogs. Some dogs don't like these head halters, but they can be used very effectively, particularly for really big dogs. So
okay.
those are the two things I go to, and I think your problems basically will be solved.
I saw a woman just the other night. I was walking, and a woman was probably 5 feet tall and 100 pounds was leading a dog with one of these
head halter.
Head halter.
Right.
And the dog probably weighed as much as she did, and He was
no
just
problem.
Fine. No
Absolutely.
Problems at all.
It's called basic physics. Get physics on your side.
Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Tom from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
My girlfriend has a silver dappled dachshund that she picked up from a rescue about 3 years ago. Her name is Pebbles.
Okay.
The dog's name, not my girlfriend.
Right. Good distinction.
The dog's about 6 years old. And when we're in my girlfriend's apartment, we'll be talking in the living room or the kitchen. And we'll be about a foot or two apart.
Yeah.
And Pebbles will be down on the floor. And she'll be yipping. She'll start yipping like she's jealous. And
the chaperone phenomenon.
Well, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I said we weren't touching each other, though. So we don't want to reward her by picking her up.
Yeah,
and good point.
And
we're not quite sure what to do, how to break her of that habit. So that way she, you know, we can just even have a conversation without her yipping and whining.
Does it happen when you hug? Also, does it get worse? Is it the same, or does it stop?
No, it just seems mostly when we're just standing there talking.
So I wonder if it's just about attention, because hugs are pretty brief, and there's some dogs who object mightily.
Well, it's usually just at the beginning of conversation.
Really?
Oh.
We'll come in from outside.
Okay.
We'll be standing in the kitchen, and we'll start a conversation. 30 seconds into it, she's at our feet, begging for attention.
All right. You know what I do? It does sound like, I think you nailed it. I think it is about attention. And, you know, girls can get jealous.
It happens.
So can guys, actually, too.
Oh,
I shouldn't be sexist about this.
Oh, yeah.
So what I would do is I would teach her an incompatible behavior and reinforce it really, really, really well. So what I would suggest doing is teaching her, why don't you just teach her lie down? Lie down and stay.
Okay.
So first work on just all by itself, nothing else going on, not you and your girlfriend talking. Just teach Pebbles to lie down. And she probably knows already, but just sort of boost it up. It's sort of fun to teach dachshunds to lie down because you're never quite really sure that they are. So use a food treat. Use the lure method where you sort of get her sitting first and then lure her down and then pop the treat in her mouth a second that she's, you know, her belly's hitting the ground. So refine that. So it's really good. So she masters it. You can say lie down and she'll lie down.
Okay.
And then work on stay. Work on that separately. Lie down, stay, and make stay really fun. You got great little treats in your mouth. Pebble, sit. Lie down, good girl. Stay, good girl, good girl. And if you give her treats while she's staying, sort of using your body and your hand to sort of help her stay down while you slide a treat underhand, which is going to have to be pretty low, down to her mouth, and then release her with this sort of like, oh, this is the boring part. You know, so it's stay, good girl, treat, and then you release her by saying, okay, boring, turn away, don't pet her head, don't give her attention for the release because that's not supposed to be the fun part, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then start working on this in the context in which your girlfriend comes in. You say, sit, lie down, stay, good Pebbles. Then your girlfriend comes in and you talk for 2 seconds. Hi, honey, how you doing? How was your good Pebbles? Give Pebbles a treat. And then release her. And so gradually reinforce her for lying down and staying while you talk to your girlfriend, but start in little microsecond intervals mm-hmm. and work. Spend the most amount of time on her staying for 2 seconds and then 3 seconds and then 5 seconds until you try and push the duration. Once you get a 2 or 3 second stay, it's easy to get to a 60-second one.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Good Pebbles.
Thanks very much,
Pebbles, you're just going to have to suck it up.
Now, where's Pebbles from? It's from a television show, a cartoon show.
Oh, another?
Flintstones.
There we go. Larry's, the deep recesses of Larry's memory is dragging out the name Pebbles from Flintstones.
Oh, boy. Here's the number to call. I haven't forgotten that. 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, we'll hear the unlikely story of a New York dressmaker who made history when she brought the first panda bear to the United States. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I am Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Vicki Croak to the program. Vicki is the author of The Lady and the Panda. It's now out in paperback. And Vicki, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Vicki, tell us about the main character of your book, Ruth Harkness. Who was she?
She's one of the most amazing people I've ever known, even though I never met her and we'll never get the chance to. She was part Jane Goodall, part Myrna Loy. She was someone who defied her time. She was very modern and progressive in her thinking way back in the 1930s. And she was someone whom everybody underestimated. And she was a dress designer and a socialite in Manhattan in 1936. And her husband was a wealthy adventurer. He was part of this great group of men. They were all Ivy League educated, wealthy, and they traveled the world and brought specimens back to the United States of animals we had never heard of, exotic specimens. Her husband had gone off to China in an attempt to be the first person to bring back a live giant panda, and he died over there. And improbably, Ruth Harkness decided she would take up his mission. She would carry on his cause and go to China. And, of course, everyone laughed at her. She laughed right along with them. I mean, one of her great lines is, she says she wouldn't know one pheasant species from another, but she was pretty certain that if she came across a giant panda, she would know what it was.
I love it.
But consider, you know, here's a woman in Manhattan who said of herself that she would not walk a city block if there were a taxicab idling nearby. And now she plans to go to what was considered at the time, and still is, you know, one of the most savage terrains on the planet, and do what these more experienced and better-funded expeditions had been unable to do for decades. So she was also a woman of this very steely determination, but because she was so charismatic and funny and striking, you know, people dismissed what she intended to do, and they didn't see that determination underneath the surface.
And she was pretty successful.
She was wildly successful. I mean, she was beyond successful. She got her panda. She went to China, and she got that panda so quickly, it made people's heads spin. It's amazing what she did. And I think in some ways, you know, my joke is that women ask for directions, and what happened in China is that so many men, Westerners, had gone into China attempting to get the panda, and they had just plotted out their own route. What Ruth Harkness did is she went to China, and she hooked up with a Chinese explorer with the assumption that he would know where he's going, he would know the terrain, and she was exactly right.
Can you expand a little bit on that? Tell us about that first panda that she eventually captured and brought back to the United States.
His name was Su Lin. They thought Ruth and then all the subsequent veterinarians and experts here in the United States thought Su Lin was a female, but was a male. The pandas are heavily furred, and their genitals are very small and partly tucked up inside of them, and so it's difficult to distinguish the two sexes. What's funny to me also is that once they got Su Lin wrong, later when Su Lin was dead and on necropsy, they saw that he was a male. They didn't say to themselves, let's take a look at the other pandas we have in captivity.
No kidding.
And rethink their gender. No one thought to do that.
Whoops.
They just continued. But Harkness, she did everything intuitively, including once the panda was in captivity, a letter that I have of hers to the Brookfield Zoo is stunning to me. She writes a letter to them saying, I'm not a scientist and I'm not an expert, but it seems to me that a panda ought to be able to eat bamboo. And that's because at the time they were feeding him canned vegetables, all the soft food, and she knew that the panda wanted to be gnawing on bamboo. And it's kind of striking to us today to read a letter like that and think that, you know, common sense was going for Ruth Harkness and that science was kind of turning its back on common sense and thinking that they were being progressive by providing the most sanitary foods possible.
Seems like common sense isn't always that common, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly right.
How did Americans react when Su Lin arrived?
I love this. You know, I think that for us today to get our minds around what Ruth Harkness did, it would be as though some famous fashion designer like Donna Karan or Stella McCartney went to the moon and brought back a creature we've never seen before. That was a sensation that she caused. Every newsreel, radio station, movies, newspapers, they were all there to cover her coming in. And you know, remember, it's during the Depression, and everyone's feeling down and out, and here comes this very striking, glamorous woman holding in her arms a creature that no one had ever seen before, not just any creature, but the panda. I mean, one of the most beloved animals of all time. And people just went crazy here in the United States.
And as a matter of fact, she had tried to sort of, if you will, peddle the panda to one zoo, and they turned her down. And then she wound up at Brookfield, if I'm not mistaken,
right, in Chicago.
And they soon learned the lucrative benefits of having a panda.
It's pretty amazing. She gets back to the United States, and she assumes, first of all, she assumed that the panda would go to the Bronx. That's where her husband always brought his catches. But the Bronx was accustomed to these rich gentlemen donating their catches to them, and they were offended that Ruth Harkness wanted $20,000 so she could go on another expedition. And so they squawked a little bit, and they said that they thought the panda had rickets because his legs were bowed. Well, of course, that's perfectly natural for pandas.
Oh, no.
And so Harkness finds herself in this crazy position of being, of having the rarest quadruped in the world, as the newspapers were saying, in her Manhattan apartment. And she's going from cocktail party to cocktail party inside taxi cabs holding the panda. Although she, which she always did, I love this, it was wintertime, and she always opened the windows to recreate the natural Tibetan atmosphere, she said.
Oh, I love it.
In her Manhattan apartment. But eventually what happened is that Brookfield Zoo was interested, and very quickly. I mean, when they first put Su Lin on display, they broke all attendance records, which have never been matched even since.
Well, you know, one of the things that's so surprising about your story when you read through it is that Ruth, after all of this attention, actually only brought two pandas in total.
Yes.
To the West. She could have become so rich and famous had she kept doing it. She was obviously successful. Why did she stop?
World War II was breaking out after she got her second panda. In fact, on her second expedition, bombs went off in Shanghai right outside her hotel room.
Yeah.
She survived that, and in fact, for that second expedition, she couldn't go down the Yangtze. She couldn't follow the same path to the mountains between China and Tibet that she had before. She went through Vietnam or French Indochina at the time. On her third expedition, she became aware of something, a phenomenon, and she was heartsick about it. Her intention in getting the first and second pandas was to establish, and this is a very modern concept, she wanted to establish a breeding colony of giant pandas in captivity to ensure their survival for the future. But the pandas were dying that were not only the ones that were brought back to the United States, her Su Lin died in the zoo, but she realized that many, many more pandas were dying during the capturing process. They were dying in traps. They were being shot. They were being hauled into cities like Chengdu, where they were kept in hot cages and would expire. Sometimes they died on the ships that brought them out. And she realized that this gold rush mentality she was partly responsible for. She brought this panda back, made everyone crazy for pandas, and unleashed this horrible situation. On her third expedition, this is a remarkable thing, and this tells you the character of Ruth Harkness. She gets another panda, and every time she goes on an expedition, she stakes her entire fortune on it. She's got to bring the panda back in order to make money to live. She's there in China. She has a baby panda in hand. And she thinks to herself, you know what, I don't want to participate in this anymore. I don't want to bring this baby panda back into captivity where it's going to die. And so she's in the city of Chengdu, and she puts her expedition in reverse, as she says, and she goes up into the mountains and sets this, what is her treasure trove, free into the mountains. And that to me was, you know, if people know the story of Ruth Harkness, they know she brought the first panda back. But in that moment of releasing the panda, to me, that's her biggest accomplishment.
And is that what we can take from her story?
Yes, she was 70 years ahead of her time. I mean, it took her 3 years to figure out the conservation of giant pandas, and it has taken us decades to catch up to her.
What a woman.
Yes, yeah. She's incredible.
Thank you very much, Vicki, for being with us today.
The Lady and the Panda.
Thank you.
That's
thank
the book,
so
The
much.
Lady and the Panda.
Vicki Croak is the author of The Lady and the Panda. She spoke to us from her home in Boston, Massachusetts. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And we have someone waiting for us right now. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
This is Amy. I'm in Delray Beach, Florida.
Amy, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a blue heeler, or also known as an Australian cattle dog, and she has some pretty interesting quirks. And the one specifically I'm calling about is that she'll run out into my yard and jump up midway onto a palm tree and just pull the bark right off it.
No kidding. I want a videotape.
And I have a series of palm trees that looks like a beaver's gotten to them at this point, and I really don't know quite why she does it, or it doesn't seem to be any apparent reason. So I'm just wondering what I should do and if I could probably get her maybe out of the habit. And there is one other thing. She chases her tail a lot, and maybe they're two related activities that I'm not quite sure.
That's important information. The fact that you've added on that she's a bit of an obsessive compulsive tail chaser, mm-hmm. that suggests to me that there's a little bit more going on. You know, there's a whole set of neurochemicals, of neurotransmitters in your brain that mediate a kind of almost addictive, compulsive kind of behavior. Dopamine is particularly important in that. And it might be that those levels in her brain are just a little bit off. But that doesn't mean you should be giving her medication necessarily, unless it's take a pill. Well, that would be something you talk to your veterinarian about. And usually, that's only necessary if it's an extreme case. And very often in cases like this, what you want to do is find something that's competitive. Find something she absolutely adores. And with most dogs, frankly, it's food. And it's great food. It's not any food. It's a piece of hamburger or liver or chicken. It's something she really, really, really adores. And then what you're going to do is you're going to teach her an incompatible behavior so that, for example, every time she looks at a palm tree, and you can even put it on cue, you can say, what's your dog's name?
Ruby.
Ruby. You can say, Ruby, where's the tree? Now have her on a leash so you don't lose control here. Stand in your backyard. Ruby, where's the tree? And if she looks at the tree, say, good girl. And then click and smooch and move away from it. You can say watch to teach her to turn and look at your mm-hmm. face on cue. And then you give her a treat for looking at the tree, and then immediately turning and looking 180 degrees away from it. Does Ruby have lots to do in life? What does Ruby do?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And I was apprehensive to get the breed. I'd had her before when I had had horses. And then I talked to the breeder and I said, well, I don't have horses anymore, and she said, oh, they'll become great house dogs. And she really doesn't have all that much activity, but she has lots of friends, so she does have playtime with them.
That's
but
good.
I know
that's
that
good.
She's a dog that needs more things to do because she is obsessive about catch and fetch, and everything that she gets hooked onto, she just completely, I have to hide everything.
She's sort of an addictive personality.
Right.
It probably is.
I've learned to love unconditionally because
there are a lot of conditions to wade through here. I'll tell you one thing I would do that I think would be very helpful is it sounds like Ruby is getting physical exercise, although with a dog like that, frankly,
you need a lot.
You know, the more the better. I mean, I remember not too long ago, I went on a horseback ride. We went 12 miles up into the mountains in Montana, and there were three dogs that went along with us. They must have run 20 miles because they were running just about all the time, and they weren't even tired. When we got back, I was exhausted. They weren't even tired. So she probably does need more physical exercise, but as importantly, if not more importantly, she needs mental exercise. Start teaching her a bunch of tricks. Get her mind going. And it's really fun. It's easy. It doesn't take a lot of time. You can go to some of the catalogs and some of the websites that sell dog books and videos. Get a couple of those and just teach her some fun tricks. Smart little dog like a healer, they can learn them in a microsecond.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Don't go away. We'll take more calls next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets.
Do you have a question for Patricia? I know. Just call the 1-800 number, right? But you're shy, and the idea of talking on the radio gives you hives. So how do you get your question on Calling All Pets? We have a solution. It's called email. Send your pet behavior questions to pets@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell. Here's the number to call if you'd like to join in, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Blue Lake, California.
Elizabeth, pleased to speak with you. How can we help?
We I've adopted two really fantastic dogs in the last year.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, Bo is a black lab. He's probably almost two, and he's just super dog. And so we got him a playmate because he's just so loving and friendly. And we got a golden retriever. We adopted her, too, so she's probably about a year old now. And she is very exuberant. She just has a zest for life.
Yeah.
She has taken over his doghouse, and we didn't catch it enough. We tried cleaning it and moving the doghouse, but he won't go in it at all. And now he's sleeping on an outdoor couch, and now she's trying to take over that, too.
Ooh,
and
I'm
bossy.
I'm not sure how to get him to want his doghouse and want his space back.
Oh, he probably wants it back a lot. But that doesn't mean he's willing to challenge this new member of
feisty
the pack
little
here.
Member.
Yeah. So do they both have a doghouse?
Yeah, there was two. So Bo we had for about 8 months before we got Abby. And so he had his doghouse and was in it every day.
Okay.
Now Abby's got two.
So Abby gets both doghouses.
Yeah, you know, she likes to take whatever. She loves everything.
Pushy girl. Everything. Does this happen when you leave them alone? They're in a dog yard? Tell me about the logistics of this.
Oh, we live on, like, this hilltop ranch, so they have a lot of space to roam, and so they go wherever they want. Basically.
But they're outside.
Yeah.
Right? And they're housed together in this big open area.
Yeah.
Right?
And we had the dog houses together, but then we separated them, and I washed all the bedding thinking that if it's just somewhere else, maybe, and it doesn't smell like, or maybe he'll take it back, but he won't even go in there.
Is this area fenced?
No.
But the reason I ask that is that this might be a situation in which they'll actually do better separated when they're out for part of the time. So like at night, when they want to go to sleep, they can each go to their own dog houses. Because there are dogs that, no matter how sweet they are to us, they're a bit of a bully to other dogs.
Oh.
I know. And
have a bully.
It's hard. Well, Larry, now look, I was trying to like be a little more discreet here. Larry just blurts it out. There, you know, some dogs who are exuberant to us are really pushy to other dogs. And if your lab is not sort of standing up for his rights, it well might be he's intimidated by this other dog. You know, dogs have social hierarchies like we do, and I think too much is made of them often. But in this case, it's perfectly reasonable to think about the fact that there's one dog who basically said, I want everything. And you're not going to do a personality transplant on your dog. And if you force the lab to trying to compete with a golden, you're going to create a dog fight.
Oh.
So you don't want to do that. So you're really going to have to protect your lab from sort of being in a corporate takeover. There's a hostile corporate takeover going on here. So could the lab live inside at night?
Yeah, maybe we could figure out something to physically keep the golden out of his area.
That's what I do. I would create a situation in which the lab doesn't have to sort of give up everything to the golden, but you're not setting up tension between the two of them. So, you know, think about having the lab in the house at night, for example.
Okay.
Give that a try.
Yeah.
See if it works.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank
good
you
luck.
So much.
Yeah, good
sounds
luck.
Gorgeous out there.
Does sound gorgeous. And it sounds like a couple of interesting dogs.
Yeah. Good luck with it.
1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Amy from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. I have a question about my cat. Her name is Sasha, and she's 4 years old.
Okay.
And whenever I go out of town or if I have to work late and I don't get home till late in the evening, I'll find that she has defecated outside of her litter box, but not it's not like she was in it and just missed. She's obviously not in it.
Not getting in it at all. Gotcha.
No, and when I do go out of town, I have friends that come in and check on her, and I even leave another litter box out. But for some reason, she chooses not to use them. And I was just calling to see if you had any suggestions on why she might be doing this or what I can do to encourage her not to do.
I do. And it's sort of like a mystery. You have to play Sherlock Holmes here, and basically you have to try one thing at a time. So stamina is a critical part of a treatment plan, and that, you know, we never really know why each individual cat does it. So you have to sort of try one thing at a time. And the first and easiest thing to try is to look at the boxes themselves. Sometimes when people try to get more boxes in, which is a very good idea because we know that cats who live outside choose to urinate and defecate in very different places. So part of the problem sometimes is that the cat just doesn't want to do both. They're unlike us, you know. We're like, we're happy to go in the same place. So the mistake that people often make is they get another litter box, but they put it right beside the first one. And that's basically just creates one sort of big litter box with a partition in between. So have you put the litter boxes in different places than the first one?
Yes, they've been in different rooms.
Okay, good for you.
Okay,
so that's so check that off. You're like, check, done that. have you, the other thing to look at is the litter itself. Some cats, they'll urinate it, but they're sort of not fond of the litter. So another thing to try is to try different types of litter. What kind do you use now?
I use Tidy Cats.
Is it the clumping kind?
Yes, because I also have a litter maid, so, and I clean it out completely every 2 weeks.
Very nice ears have sort of pricked up like a dog who just heard a squirrel out the window. So when you say you got a different box, did you get just a regular plain box?
No, so she's had the same litter box for about the whole entire time that she's been doing this, and it's a litter maid. So it's constantly cleaning it out every time she uses it. Because I thought she was just really, really picky.
Right. What I'm hypothesizing is it's possible that that type of box that is a self-cleaning box might actually be part of what's keeping her from defecating in it. So what I would do is I would get some plain boxes. And the trick is to get big ones. Most litter boxes are actually too small for cats. And even if they're really big, you can get her defecating in an established area and then try and cut the sides of the box down. But I would try using plain boxes. Sometimes those self-cleaning boxes actually put cats off a little bit.
You know, we had a pet tip relating to this. A listener from, a listener named Leonard from Madison, Wisconsin, sent us a pet tip about how he solved this problem. And this is what he wrote. Our cat persistently pooped on the wood floor next to the litter box.
Okay.
We started to mound the kitty litter at one end of the box, leaving a space in the box that had no litter.
That's very smart.
Yeah, now the cat poops in the box on the bare space. It's stinky, but it's better than going on the floor.
That's very smart. That, you know, just look at what does the cat want and try and create it. That was really smart. And that brings up something that I didn't mention that can often be very important. A lot of us put a lot of litter in the box because we think that's somehow cleaner, or, you know, we're American, so bigger is better. I don't know why we do it. But it turns out they don't want that much litter. I think their paws sink in it, and then they don't know what they're sinking into. As far as they know, they're going to sink in the feces from last, you know, night or something. So try, first of all, try having less litter, which also might be a problem with sort of some of those self-cleaning litter boxes. But I like his idea, too. I think that's really smart.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
And to send pet tips, where do we send
them? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And here's the number for you to call to join in, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Amber from Boise, Idaho.
Amber, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I had a cat named Pride, and when my daughter used to get upset, she would bite at my daughter. And my daughter is kind of a loud crier. And she wouldn't bite hard, but it was almost like she would bite her with her teeth and try and drag her somewhere.
Oh, dear.
Wow. I wasn't ever sure if she didn't like the noise, and so it would upset the cat and it would bite at her, or if she thought she was trying to protect her and drag her, like, underneath her bed.
It's hard to imagine, frankly. Although, I guess it's possible that if the noises your daughter was making, how old is your daughter, by the way?
She was 4 at the time, like between 4 and 6.
Oh, okay. I was thinking if your daughter was very, very young and she was making squeaky noises, perhaps like a little young kitten or something.
No, and this is very loud. I mean, my daughter bawls. She's very dramatic. So.
I think it's not then about protection. It's probably, there are a lot of cats. There are a lot of animals who are very sound sensitive, and they vary as much as we are. You know, some of us are very sound sensitive, and some aren't. And there are, I hear a lot about both cats and dogs and birds who react in some relatively dramatic way to loud noises, particularly from kids. You know, kids don't regulate their amplitude very well.
Yeah.
And they can get very loud, as we all know. And so my guess is that she is in some way trying to get your daughter to stop. Now that your daughter is a little older, has it stopped at all?
She actually actually, my cat trained my daughter not to cry.
Give that cat a treat.
She's actually stopped, you know, because Pride would come up and try and bite at her. And so she's like, I always say, you know, if you want, you know, the cat would never, like, hurt her. Was never biting her hard enough, you know, to, like, draw blood or anything like that. But she would, I say, if you want the cat to stop, you need to stop crying.
And so she would stop. Well, I think I need to be careful not to recommend this. Teach your cat to bite your daughter when she's crying.
No.
Probably not a good thing to recommend, but you know, sometimes life just works out
right. Really
sweetly. You know, your daughter's probably going to be on a couch in 20 years saying, I was never allowed to cry.
No, I hope not.
But right now it sounds really good.
Thanks, Amber.
Okay, thank you.
It's a great story.
Thanks very much for calling. And Patricia, thank you. It'll be great to get back together again in another week or so.
Be here in a week.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets. Next, Calling All Pets, we're going to find out which animals don't need mates when it comes to having babies.
And we'll also welcome a guest to talk about his amazing 5-month journey following a caribou herd's migration.
Tune in for that and more of your calls on the very next Calling All Pets.